Hi, I'm Frances Anderton and this is DNA. The long-planned Academy Museum comes into focus.
When it first came out, I was kind of feeling like, oh boy, another out-of-town architect is inflicting an obnoxious, iconic form on the poor city of LA in the name of Hollywood. But actually, since then, it seems to have floated back to earth, and I'm really thrilled with the direction it's taking.
And we'll hear about why the Sphere has come back into architectural style. First up, though, is there anything designers of public space and planners of public events can do to avert mass shootings, like the one that occurred Sunday night at a country music festival in Las Vegas? This was yet another massacre at a public event that was meant only to bring pleasure and a sense of community. It follows other attacks at public gatherings in Paris, Manchester, London, Nice, Miami and New York, among other cities, that have been destroyed by shootings, bombs and vehicle attacks. Leaving aside the debate about gun control, could Sunday's attack have been prevented? We reached out to Chris Robinette. He is president of a security consultancy called Prevent Advisors.
There's very, very little that can be done about this event in particular, given the resources and the nature of the jurisdictions, as I would call it, the geography and the geometry. So the concert and event promoters are only generally responsible for planning and preparing and securing the concert site. The hotel, you know, directors of security staff there are responsible for that facility, and local law enforcement municipality has generally overarching. So there's a lot of themes where those things meet, and that is where this event occurred. And so cooperation and collaboration is becoming ever more important in deterring and preventing these events.
So cooperation and collaboration could, what, take the form of hotels checking the bags of their guests, or there being a clean sweep of the entire area before a concert begins, and taking the hotels into that net as well?
Sure. Anybody that's going to be a stakeholder in that equation now is going to bear some responsibility to try and make sure that their area is clear and free of threat and risks, and where they potentially can occur, they've put in appropriate mitigation.
You referred to geometry and geography. What did you mean by that?
Right. Well, the geography is one in which kind of the environment takes place, right? So are you a closed event, or are you an outdoor venue? And then the geometry, right? So in this instance, there was an active shooter from an elevated position across the divided highway. We talk about open air venues, everything from conferences or convention centers or concerts, stadiums. Open air events have everything from drones and aerial incursion to potential active shooters that have line of sight into those venues. You know, you might have to account for things like open spaces and parking lots. All these features are important and relevant to plan against when taking public safety into account.
Now, I understand that you yourself are a veteran of the Army Special Forces. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So what do you learn from that, which you now apply to security?
I think a lot of this is just understanding the nature of the threat, whether they be firearms or otherwise, and how to create safe distances or how to secure areas where an active shooter might place themselves. And there's a lot of things that can be done on the preventative and deterrence side of things, just as planning and preparation and preparedness to respond in the event that there is a tragic incident like we've seen in Bataclan or Bill Pulse nightclub or what we saw in Manchester or now here in Las Vegas. They all require a very rehearsed response from first responders, from safety and security personnel working the event, to guest services.
And what about designers of these kind of spaces? Do you work with designers?
We do a lot of that, actually. We're in a bid process for Key Arena in Seattle and Belmont in New York. And there's a lot of things that you can do at the design phase to eliminate or work some of those things out.
Like what?
Well, simple things like we've recently seen vehicle ramming, and that's been a problem recently in Europe. We saw an incident of it this weekend in Canada. You know, creating elevation change or barriers, and they need not be sort of intrusive or visually unappealing. There's a lot of ways to design in those safety features and have it be very organic to the environment, right? We talk about layered security, making sure that people flow through large open spaces, which facilitate and accommodate evacuation should that be required. Hardware and software solutions augmenting that, as well as, you know, should there be an incident, making sure that first responders can get to that site without a lot of friction or congestion.
You just referred to hardware and software. Are you talking about things like gunshot detection sensors?
Sure. So everything from a good command and control center that has good hardware and software that allows you to monitor situational awareness, you know, where threats may exist, communication to and from law enforcement or emergency first responders. You know, hardware can come in the form of canine dogs that, you know, have the ability to detect firearms or detect explosives. Counter drone technology is kind of emerging. You know, on the very high end of things, there's facilities around the world that are looking at facial recognition as a means to scan large groups of people moving through smaller confined areas. There's a lot of emerging technology out there now to allow like more efficient screening and metal detectors. There's really been a lot of evolution over the last decade in that field.
And yet, despite everything you've said, what one reads about these Sunday events in Las Vegas is that total chaos descended. Is there anything that you would recommend a concert goer to do to be prepared in advance for, you know, the worst happening?
Sure. This is a bit of the new normal now, right? So we've seen a number of these events, and the likelihood that they will occur is still very high, as infrequent as that may be. And so people should generally be prepared and understand that if an incident or event occurs, they should familiarize themselves with where exits are, what they're going to do to communicate with their group, where they should go and what they should do in the case of an event, and have the ability and the means to know where to get information or how to report to, you know, law enforcement or public safety entities there should they see suspicious activity, and to know what those look like.
Is there anything that we can learn here from other countries in terms of managing public safety?
Yeah, you know, I will tell you that a lot of the countries in Western Europe have been dealing with this type of problem for a very long period of time. So I would say England, France, Germany, Spain, areas where we see these things typically have also occurred. Sharing those lessons learned, you know, from painful events and how we can all be better is certainly a step in the right direction.
Lastly, was this a fairly unusual situation where you had a guy 32 floors above an event that was taking place?
Yeah, there's a real bit of uniqueness to this scenario. It's a bit of a nightmare scenario. Again, it kind of falls between the seams where the shooter was placed in an environment that wasn't controlled or monitored by the concert promoter and the venue security staff, right? But the likelihood that these types of things will go unmitigated in the future is low. This is now part of kind of what we recognize as an emerging and real part of the threat. And so it's going to have to be addressed moving forward, and it certainly will be.
Well, Chris Robinette, thank you so much for giving us your time.
I appreciate it.
That was Chris Robinette. He's president of a security consultancy called Prevent Advisors. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, a leading voice in the pro-housing advocacy movement is now running for elected office in San Francisco.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Last week, Governor Jerry Brown signed 15 bills intended to enable the construction of new housing in California. Here's one of the bill's authors, State Senator Nancy Skinner. She's a Democrat from Berkeley.
And my bills, by tackling the not-in-my-backyard obstacles that unfortunately occur in many of our communities, will help ensure that the housing actually gets built.
These bills mark a victory for a growing movement called YIMBY, or Yes in My Backyard. Let's hear from one of its leading voices.
Hi, I'm Sonia Trouse. I started the SF Bay Area Renters Federation, also known as SF BARF. And then we joined and formed a bigger organization called the YIMBY Party, Yes in My Backyard. And then late 2015, I co-founded a nonprofit that enforces state housing law. And now I'm running for supervisor in District 6 in San Francisco.
Okay, Sonia, partly thanks to the efforts of groups like yours, 15 housing bills were signed last week by Governor Brown. What do you think of the passage of these bills? And do you think it's going to make a difference to the housing picture in the state of California?
I'm thrilled about them, and absolutely all the advocates hope it makes a huge difference. The package includes funding bills, bills that make it easier to encourage developers to set aside parts of their developments to be below market rate. And it includes a bunch of streamlining bills to make it harder for opponents of housing to interfere with its production. So it is very exciting. But the reality is that California has actually had some really great housing laws for 30 years. And it really takes local communities to decide to follow them. So individuals in their own neighborhoods, they still need to come and show support for housing at their city councils and at their neighborhood meetings.
Now, why are you running for supervisor?
We've had so much success having really good relationships with supervisors. And now is an opportunity in this race to make sure that there's somebody in this position who's really going to continue to bring the pro-housing, pro-infill, pro-human-scale development angle to the city.
So where exactly is District 6?
District 6 includes part of the downtown, central business district. It's like the northeast corner of San Francisco. It also includes the Tenderloin. It's really the densest part of San Francisco. In the last 10 years, this one district has built 60% of San Francisco's housing.
So this is not a district where you feel you're going to need to be fighting for housing. It's the other districts that need to step up.
Yeah, I mean, we did it. District 6 residents get it. Like, we're the housing district. And also the jobs district, and also the manufacturing district. It's really an incredible, it's the best. It's the best district in all of San Francisco, obviously. I think that.
Now, Sonia, you and I spoke on the phone a year ago when you were having some successes as a YIMBY activist. And at that time, one really got the impression that you were kind of enjoying being an activist and you were enjoying being kind of annoying to people, like showing up at planning meetings and suing suburbanites and so on. Now, as a supervisor, obviously, you have to represent a wide spectrum of individuals and interests and you kind of have to get serious. So are you ready for that?
It is completely different. I mean, it's fascinating because as an activist, the people on your mailing list, the people that you're representing all believe the same thing. But as a supervisor, the only thing your constituents have in common is that they live in the same area, which means you're absolutely right. You're much more of a mediator and then also an administrator. I mean, the Board of Supervisors is basically it's like the board of directors for the city.
You do have, as I understand it, a competitor in this race, Matt Haney, who's a more traditional progressive, I guess, and already a member of the Board of Education. What differentiates you from him and why are you so confident you're going to win?
Well, for something like this, you have to believe you're going to win, right? But I think the biggest differentiation between us is our energy and our records.
Are you invoking the low energy descriptor?
perhaps. Let me just say that I think I've accomplished more in the last 3 years than he has in his political career, which has lasted over a decade.
You've definitely accomplished a lot, Sonia. Just this year, you were selected by Politico magazine as representative of one of the 50 ideas that's blowing up right now. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
But along the way, part of your success has been to be a provocateur. And part of that provocation has been to occasionally let slip things that you now have to account for. So now you, for example, are being criticized for various things you've written. One of them, a tweet in which you call gentrification, quote, the revaluation of black land to its correct price. I think I understand what you mean by that, but I can also see why people would get bothered by that. What did you mean by it?
Well, that when a neighborhood is gentrifying, I mean, if it's an African-American neighborhood, then that means that the homeowners in that neighborhood, the black homeowners, their property values are going up. And, you know, not everybody actually wants their property value to go up, but a lot of Americans do. And it's one of actually the many injustices, like one of the examples of institutional racism in the U.S. is that, one, as an African-American, it's harder to become a homeowner. And two, if you do become a homeowner, your house value is lower than if you were a white person just because you're black. And it's something that was institutionalized formally in the 30s. That's what redlining is. And even though, I guess sometimes in the 50s, the FHA stopped formally devaluing black-owned land, homes that African-Americans live in, there's still a legacy of that. What happens, you know, gentrification, among other things, has many, many effects. But one of them is that those black homeowners whose home values are unfairly low finally see their home values appreciate in the way that their houses would have appreciated if they were in a white neighborhood.
So in that sense, you're seeking a social equity. However, do you not support intervention into the market to keep housing prices or to keep some rental prices down?
We have a market process now, so that's our reality. That said, within that reality, absolutely, the state does and should more, spend money subsidizing housing for people who don't make enough on their own to live somewhere that's safe and healthy.
Do you still advocate, now you're running for supervisor, for the sort of untrammeled housing construction that you were associated with in your activist phase?
No housing construction is ever untrammeled. Housing, just like every other part of our economy, is heavily regulated, which is a good thing. This whole time, what we've been advocating for primarily is that people be allowed to build to their zoning within the laws.
Got it. The buy right. The buy right. Because you're saying that neighborhoods
right.
have fought the buy right development.
Exactly. And what buy right means is that cities make rules about what should be built where, and that we should be carrying out the plans that our cities make. And it's amazing that that winds up being very radical.
Now, Sonia, you are about to have a child and you just got married. So you are moving into a different phase in your life. And it's a phase at which, you know, many, many Americans start thinking about moving out of the city, perhaps into a more suburban type environment, perhaps the single family home, getting the yard. There's talk of, you know, the millennials now looking for something that's a kind of hybrid of suburb and urb. I think it's the phrase is even suburbs. Do you feel perhaps that you might get to a slightly different mindset where you start to understand some of the folks who have been so resistant to seeing their neighborhoods be changed by greater density?
Well, as far as a yard goes, I don't want a yard. I don't want to mow. I've already actually for a long time understood why people want big houses, you know, or big apartments. I myself have two parents, two brothers, and growing up, we had other people living with us too. You know, my dad's cousin lived with us for a while. So I totally understand why people want to live in big houses. But you can have big apartments in the city. One thing about my childhood growing up that I definitely want to replicate is that I was able to walk around my neighborhood and get myself places on my own. I walked to my friend's house, to my school, starting when I was like 7 years old.
Where was this neighborhood?
In Germantown in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm.
There were some who say to the pro-housing activists in the west of this country, they say these regions are designed in such a way that does not accommodate density, that does not accommodate a huge influx of new people. And those new people, rather than fussing about housing prices, should just move to other cities. Go to Detroit, go to St. Louis, go to these cities where you can buy property cheaply and don't keep putting pressure on our neighborhood. What do you say to those people?
Well, I mean, this is where the jobs are. We're moving away from Detroit and St. Louis because we don't have jobs there. I live literally St. Louis. I lived in St. Louis before I lived in San Francisco. And I moved because there just weren't jobs.
That was Sonia Trauss. She's a YIMBY activist, and she is now running to be San Francisco's District 6 supervisor. That election will be held in November of 2018. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA.
The Ruby Slippers, what have you done with them? Give them back to me or I'll...
It's too late. There they are, and there they'll stay.
Ah, yes, Dorothy's ruby red slippers from the 1939 film The Wizard of Oz. One of the last surviving pairs will soon be on display in a museum now under construction at the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax. We're talking about the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures, now known as the Academy Museum. It was first dreamed up a century ago by silent film star Mary Pickford. And last week we got a preview of the complex designed by Italian architect Renzo Piano.
The structure here that we're looking at is 26 million pounds of concrete and steel.
Our tour included Rich Cherry, Chief Operating Officer of the Academy Museum, showing us an icon in the making, the giant sphere connected by two bridges to the retrofitted 1939 streamlined modern May Company building, now to be known as the Saban Building. The sphere is going to contain an auditorium and it will have a rooftop gathering space with a spectacular view of the Hollywood Hills. Here's the Academy Museum's director, Kerry Brower.
First, let me just say that working with Renzo has been such a delight. So we've been able to actually come together and figure out what works cinematically in the building and then what will work cinematically in the exhibitions. And he has been great about being flexible with the interior spaces. We changed a few things in the interior spaces of the May Company. We moved a couple theaters that were sitting right in the middle of the exhibition spaces downstairs to become one big theater, which was a much better theater for us to use, and then freed up the exhibition space. So we've made some changes like that in the inside. And the sphere itself has, of course, been refined over time by Renzo. And I think it's a very, very punchy and fantastic, almost machine that has been put on the north side of the building that makes you feel like it's going to take you somewhere. It's going to launch you some other place, just like a movie theater does.
Is that what you meant when you used the term talking with Renzo about achieving your goals cinematically within the building? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, I actually think that the way Renzo thinks about architecture is, and this is, I think, kind of serendipitous but wonderful for me, is the fact that he thinks about it cinematically. Cinema is nothing if it's not about light and shadow. And that's a way we're also thinking about the exhibition spaces. He also thinks about architecture as compression and expansion. And we think about the cinema that way too, as quiet moments and then action moments or large landscapes, you know, compared to more intimate scenes. So the juxtaposition of those things together as you move through the building creates a kind of cinematic structure. Moving across the bridges puts you in big daylight. Moving back into a tunnel into darkness, then coming out on the terrace puts you with this landscape of Hollywood in front of you. It's a cinematic moment.
And it's also a civic moment because Renzo tends to do the interior experience and then you step out and you've got the exterior connection with the city.
Well, Renzo loves piazzas, and we've got an amazing piazza out here. And so really the outside and the inside are connected. It's kind of a flow that moves from the Disney piazza outside and under the sphere. The sphere, of course, kind of floats, and you can walk right under it, right into the building, through the glass, into the building, and then it continues right out onto Wilshire Boulevard. I mean, this has really become, this neighborhood has, all the vectors are coming together. You have the Academy Museum going in, the Peterson just renovated across the street, which is the Automobile Museum. You have this incredible new expansion of LACMA with the Zumtor project, the Tar Pit Museum, and now you really do have a series of museums along here. It is the Miracle Mile, as it used to be called.
That was Kerry Brower, director of the Academy Museum. Now, the museum had spent some time in development hell, but now things are looking up. A $50 million check from Haim and Cheryl Saban has given a big boost to the fundraising, and that name change to the May Company building, and the spherical auditorium building is triumphing over the construction challenges. Anne Gray is an architect who publishes a magazine called Form. We met her on the tour.
Yeah, so the sphere, when it first came out, I was kind of feeling like, oh boy, another out-of-town architect is inflicting an obnoxious, iconic form on the poor city of L.A. in the name of Hollywood. But actually, since then, it's become much more grounded. It's got a more friendly, let's say, sympathetic relationship to the rest of the buildings on the site and in the campus. And it seems to have floated back to earth, and I'm really thrilled with the direction it's taking.
But it's floated back to earth by becoming not an entire sphere. About half the sphere is made of concrete. A bottom half is cantilevered over space, and then the top half is glass.
Right, so by dividing the sphere that way, it reflects the programmatic components of what's happening inside the sphere, which is nice to be able to read on the outside of it. Just the construction piece of it is a masterpiece of engineering in itself, and it's astonishing to realize that all of this formwork and bracing is temporary, as beautiful and strong as it is, but it's what it takes to give the sphere the illusion of floating.
Now, this is not the only new institution in LA to feature a sphere. Recently, we heard on this show from Jacques Herzog of Swiss firm Herzog & de Meuron about their design for the proposed Berggruen Institute in the Santa Monica Mountains. This would include two spheres. One would be a water tank and the other an auditorium.
They have been fascinating for architects since many centuries. And, you know, we all know these utopian architectures of the 18th century French, the Age of Enlightenment, where the sphere had a very clear position, intellectual position, up to Bachmann's Fuller, where the sphere was seen as, in his interpretation, as an amazing technical achievement. So we very much like this double function, that the sphere is at the same time something banal and like pop art or pop architecture, and something so spiritual.
That was Jacques Herzog. He also told us the sphere was an existing pure form, not a new digitally sculpted architectural shape. Spheres have also appeared in several design competitions recently, so we asked Anne Gray, why are they making a comeback?
Well, you know, I think it's a couple of things. First of all, when architects realize that they're unbound by the physics of gravity and the technology of construction allowed them to do curves. Of course, they had to do like a jillion irregular radiuses and compound curves, and they probably exhausted themselves somewhat, and they're coming back to the pure form of a spherical curve. Also, in maybe some nostalgia for the 60s and futurism.
That was Anne Gray. She's publisher of Form magazine. The Academy Museum is set to open in 2019. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.